Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And our program is live today. You can reach us with questions about our main topic, which is disasters in your kitchen, 410-662-8780. Or it could be as simple as you can't follow a recipe very well, or a struggle with a translation or a term.
Yeah, and happy to answer any questions.
Exactly. So you're, I was trying to get you to give up some recent misstep. You said you had inconsistency with your soufflés, although there were plenty that were perfect. That's not exactly...
That's not good enough.
You're not giving
That's
a whole lot.
Is that a failure?
No.
Let me see.
It could
sorry,
be one
Tony.
In the past. I'm looking for some
I think we need to go back a little further. I can't say recently. Not being arrogant, but I mean, you know, I hope I know how to cook by now.
Sometimes there are opportunities when things happen that you don't expect. That's
the
other thing.
Well, no, that's different. And that's when, like, I made Crowder pea soup. Oh my gosh, I love fresh Crowder peas, and we're getting them locally. And I made Crowder pea soup, and I made it so differently from how I would normally. And I made it with just a ton of bacon, smoked, really good smoked bacon, and good stock. And I always put onions and all these things in. And I didn't do any of that. And I also cooked white beans. I was making white bean, butternut squash, and andouille sausage risotto and while I was making my Crowder pea soup. And I thought, wow, you know, I really want to put some of those white beans, because I was going to puree the Crowder pea soup. And I want to put some of the white beans in there, too. I loved what was happening in the pan while the white beans were cooking, because I had rosemary in that pan and saffron and a lot of things. And while the Crowder peas were cooking, which have this really just of the earth taste. Oh my gosh.
They have their own minerally smoky flavor.
Yeah, they're amazing. And so I did probably 90% Crowder peas and 10% of the white cocoa beans and their own broths and pureed the soup. But gosh, when you ate the soup, it was just like literally eating the, I told the waiters, it's like almost like dirt in a really good way. I mean, I really do mean that. And you know, it was like the most base of flavors.
It's hard
it was
to get that
so
across
gorgeous,
on the radio.
But I think they
really
can understand my excitement. And if only they could see my hands moving right now, they would get how happy I am. I'm just like, oh my gosh, I've never made that soup that way. And that is the beauty of cooking to me. You know, something going on one pot and you're like, oh my gosh, I could even add a little bit of that to this. And that's the beauty of cooking.
Let me back you up one second.
Oh boy, Tony's got his finger in the air.
No pork product.
What about it?
Well, there was no pork product?
Oh, no. I put a bunch of bacon in the... No. I said I put a bunch of bacon in with the Crowder peas. I put like 2 pounds of bacon in with the Crowder peas. I mean, there was just
massive...
I thought
you were saying you were like getting past all of that. And
oh, no.
You were channeling
a
vegan dream or something.
Oh, well, I may be channeling a vegan dream at some point, but right now I'm talking about Crowder peas with a whole bunch of bacon and good chicken stock, and then the white beans were cooking in a separate pot with a lot of aromatics. It was just two very different things, but mostly it was the fact that the Crowder peas just have this amazing flavor. So, and also my point is that cooking is a living, breathing process, and as you're cooking, once you do have some sense of cooking, or even if you don't, just experiment a little bit. It's fun. I mean, it is an art form. It is something that, I mean, in the end, you know, if you have some understanding of cooking, you know, just put fresh things in. You're not going to make something that's just absolutely awful, although you may have technical issues. And I think that's what we were, you know, kind of planning on talking about. And even if I make, like, let's say I'm in a hurry and I go to make a vinaigrette and I don't emulsify it correctly because I'm in a hurry, or a cook might do that. And then how do you bring that back? And I think that those are valid.
I'm going to tell you that I think that at home, maybe 1% of people make a vinaigrette with an egg and emulsify it.
And that's so good that way.
You know, but I'm telling you, I think that people at home,
they don't do that.
Do not do that.
It's not, I mean, you know, it's sort of the foundation of a vinaigrette, a mayonnaise, a hollandaise. You know, it's all the idea of the fat, a protein accepting fat, and how much can the protein, which in this case is an egg yolk, can handle, which is up to a cup of fat in most cases. How do you emulsify the fat into the protein, the egg yolk? And you need acid to balance it and to also have the process happen. So with a vinaigrette, you whisk your egg yolk with red wine vinegar or whatever kind of tarragon vinegar, anything that you like. It could be lemon or lime juice, any form of acid. And also mustard is a very important part of making a good dressing, a good vinaigrette.
Well, and there's plenty of acid in the
mustard.
About Dijon mustard, yeah.
Right. So Dijon mustard, whisk it in with the egg yolk. Always better to work with the egg yolks when they're at room temperature rather than cold. You know, you want everything to be in balance. So you don't need that much mustard. If you're making dressing for two people, you're probably making, you know, maybe half a cup. When you are working with an egg yolk, you need to make it and eat it that day. You're not going to keep an egg yolk vinaigrette in the refrigerator. You can make vinaigrette without an egg yolk and just whisk the vinegar into the mustard and make a dressing. That you could keep in your refrigerator and not have any issues. But I wouldn't sit on an egg yolk-based dressing for too long.
I think that it is easier to do than people think, was my point.
Right.
And I think that they very rarely do that. But the change in the texture of the dressing and what it actually does and how it clings to what you're using it for is very different. It changes into a much creamier texture thing without any dairy being added
to it. Right, right. And you can always add water to it also. I mean, rather than adding more vinegar to thin it out, you can add a little bit of water to your vinaigrette as you're making. You want to drizzle.
And then it'll just emulsify.
And everything's drizzling. You're whisking. And another kind of maybe a trick that people wouldn't know is that you're trying to make this in a bowl that you're whisking by hand, if you're doing it by hand, which I would. And you can certainly make it in a food processor.
Well, if you make it by hand, you're actually going to learn the process.
And that's how you should learn to cook. You should do
and
everything by hand.
And eventually you whisk enough, you get Popeye forearms.
Well, if you put a small pot and your bowl and a wet towel over the pot and you put the bowl in it, that'll hold the bowl steady for you. So that's just a little something that makes it easier to whisk your vinaigrette rather than, you know, you can't just put a, you know, you don't have enough hands to pour and to whisk and to have a bowl jumping around on your counter. So that's a good thing. And also when we make hollandaise, of course, do you make hollandaise, it has to be over water. So warm water to make the hollandaise. So it's already in that situation. So a bowl, but without a towel, a bowl in a pot that's the right size with warm water underneath it. That's to make hollandaise.
Technique very simple, very similar, but
mm-hmm. And when I'm saying in warm. A pot, you're obviously putting it on your countertop to make a vinaigrette. You're not making it hot. You're just using it as a vessel to keep the bowl from jumping around on your counter and allowing you to use both of your hands to pour oil and whisk.
That's funny. It's funny that you went back and described that so that people wouldn't make the misstep, and that's just what I don't see in recipes a lot of times. Let's take a call from Charlene and Frederick.
Hi, Charlene.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. The point, I was just listening to the using the egg. It sounds great, but we always read about salmonella, and that's, I think, one of my fears about using a raw egg white.
Mm-hmm.
Raw egg. But anyway, that was my question.
What I would say about the salmonella is if you have a great source for the eggs, nothing is guaranteed. If you're nervous about doing it, don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
It's not something. Okay, that's not something that an awful lot of people have had issues with. But if you're going to be scared of it, or scared of it offering it to your family or friends or whatever, then don't do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
right. That makes sense. Okay, so my sisters and I tend to make this one scallop potato or scallop.
Mm-hmm.
I forget how to say it.
Of course, scallop potato.
I follow the recipe, and sometimes it just, when we first started to make it with the russet potatoes, the recipe would come out very good, and I think I make it, the same way every time, but sometimes the potatoes are too firm, it's nice if they're, you know, a little al dente, a little firm, but sometimes they're too firm, and I think I keep, you know, I follow the same amount of time cooking in the oven, and I make sure all of the potatoes are immersed in the
liquid. Right.
So I don't know why that happens sometimes. I was curious if there's why that might happen sometimes it's firmer than others.
Okay.
It's the potatoes or your oven, one or the other.
So I'll tell you right now, I love to make potato gratin. First of all, I love to eat it, so I often will make this at home, especially when I'm entertaining, because it's such a great way to make a potato product for a bunch of people, and all you have to do is make it and pop it in the oven. So I totally understand why you make it for your family, and we love potatoes in our country anyway. So I use Yukon Gold potatoes to make my potato gratin. I use an Asian slicer, and I slice them quite thin. They're almost paper thin so that they cook within a 45-minute time. So I slice them all exactly the same way. And maybe, I don't know, are you using a slicer or are you cutting them by hand?
No, I'm using my food processor.
Okay, so they're consistent and that's perfect. I start off, I don't love a lot of garlic and I certainly don't like raw garlic too much, but I will rub a little bit of garlic in the bottom of the gratin dish. I won't leave it in, but I'll rub it around. Then I put a little bit of butter and a little bit of cream in the bottom of the gratin dish. And then I start my first layer of potatoes. And then I just coat those, with the cream and a little bit of cheese. I alternate layers, cream and cheese, and then the next layer won't have cheese. A little bit of salt and pepper. And I probably go up about 3/4 of the way of whatever my dish is. And I use a real gratin dish. So I guess that's about an inch, inch and a half. And I do cover it with foil. So it steams from the beginning. And I do about 325 degrees in a still oven. You can do it in a convected oven. But just keep an eye on it. I check it to make sure that it, one, it's not bubbling over. Two, that it's not browning quicker than I think it should be. And then near the end, I take the foil off. So one, that allows it to steam while it's roasting, and two, and that's good for your potatoes. And two, at the end, it gives you a chance to really brown it beautifully without over browning it. And you also don't want the cream and butter to separate, or the cheese, cream and butter to separate. So you have to watch your temperature. But yeah, as long as your potatoes are sliced evenly and they're nice and thin, you should, well, and also I'll use a paring knife. I'll just stick a paring knife directly into the gratin to test, almost like a cake tester, to test to see how firm they are. And that way I know if I have further to go with them. Does that help?
Yeah, I've done that, and I've kept it in a little longer for that reason. But yeah, that helps a lot.
Okay, good.
I have a suggestion. Pepper jack cheese is delicious.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much for the call.
All right, thank you.
Have a good day.
You too, bye.
Bye.
And so if you have other recipes you're getting stuck on, other recipes that are an issue, or if you have a recipe that you've been wanting to make and you can't read the recipe and actually understand what it is that they're trying to say, for goodness sake, give us a ring, 410-662-8780 or 866-661-9309, toll free.
You know, we were talking briefly about souffle, and, you know, there's just so many things you can do wrong making a souffle. The base itself, Julia Child has the best Gramignan recipe in her cookbook, period. It's perfect. Nice.
But the difference is maybe that you know how to read that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and true.
And you know what a lot of the expectations are. And you've made and honestly, I'm sure the first few times you did it, you got the errors out of the way.
Oh, definitely.
Some of cooking is just getting.
Yeah, you have to try.
Getting the errors out of the way.
Right. Well, yeah, because if you just slightly underwhip the whites, or if you don't fold them into the base correctly, or if you don't make your base, which is flour whisked with milk and then sugar, and then you actually boil it on the stove for a moment, and then you take it off the heat, let it cool for a minute, and add egg yolks and a little bit of room temperature butter, and then you can add your Grand Marnier. I mean, if you overcook that, if you undercook it, I mean, it's really a process. So to me, that's, I think, one of the things that's so daunting about particularly souffle, and then the egg whites have to be whipped just exactly right.
Well, oftentimes even you've described to people making roux,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it should be like sand at
low tide.
Until you've made a roux and screwed it up and then made a roux and done it right, you don't really know. I mean, honestly, people won't know what you're saying.
Well, and also with a roux, I mean, a lot of people just like put the butter on, get it really hot. And the whole thing is the butter has to gently melt. And then on low heat, you add the flour. You can't do anything on high heat. It's a process where you have to be patient. And that's another thing about cooking. A lot of the things that we do take, I mean, it's a labor of love cooking. I mean, if you're going to make risotto, it's a 20-minute process, 25-minute process. Or if you're going to make paella.
Or longer if you're going to screw it up like I did a couple of years ago. The I've got two emails from listeners here.
Good.
Mary, who called us about cooking soft flesh fish. It's hard to say. She wanted to know how to make a good stock. Her stock is always cloudy.
Okay.
What is she doing wrong?
The big thing, the reason for a cloudy stock is fat and boiling. So when you go to make a stock.
So meaning that you're not getting the fat out of the stock as you're making it.
Right.
And it's being cooked too fast. It's not simmering, the bubbling.
Right.
It's boiling, actually turning over itself.
Right. So again, stock is a labor of love. You if you're doing a brown stock where you're browning your bones, all the fat needs to be degreased from the, you know, once that pan, you don't want any of that fat in your stock. You put your brown bones in the pot with mirepoix, carrot, celery, and onion, aromatics, bay leaf, thyme, and dried peppercorns, and you can certainly add other things to your stock, but that's just, say, a base stock. You put cold water to cover. It has to be cold water. Cold water allows the impurities to rise to the top of the pot in the form of what we call scum, and also the fat rises to the top of the pot.
It's a slow rise in the temperature mm-hmm. that makes that happen.
Exactly. It allows it to release, and impurities are actually dry, are blood and whatever. So that's coming up in the form of scum and then fat. And you use a ladle to degrease and to remove the scum. So that's part of the process. So once it comes up to a boil, you immediately have to turn it down to the lowest simmer. A bubble should break the surface every second. That's it. So that's how slow a stock needs to go. And you should always skim. You see something come up, skim it, skim it, skim it. And that will leave you with a clear as a bell, beautiful stock, or it should.
I think people will also honestly overfill a stock pot sometimes at home. Mm. People don't have giant stock pots, and they put great big bones and great big carcasses in these stock pots, and and they have that
bones
and
need to
aromatics
be
and all this product. And
well, if you're using veal leg bones, they have to be cut into pieces so that the marrow is more accessible. And if you're using chicken bones, and that's where you're going to get a lot of fat. If you're, and I like I make my stock with veal and chicken bones. Veal, the chicken bones give flavor, and the veal bones gives the viscosity, the gelatin aspect of your stock, and which gives you viscosity for your, in turn, your sauce when you reduce it down. So you need the marrow bones, the serious veal leg bones, to make a good veal stock. You're going to have a beautiful stock at the end of that.
I have more email questions from Louisa in Towson. No, I'm sorry. Now it says from Lewis in Towson. I'm not sure. I apologize whether it's Louisa or Lewis. I'm getting half of it wrong. Can you make a vinaigrette with powdered eggs instead of fresh for storage reasons?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I've never worked with powdered eggs, so I can't.
Yeah, I think
answer that.
There probably is a way to get it to work, you know, with your chemistry kit, but it's not something that either one of us has experience with.
I would just make it maybe without the eggs. So, you know, with the Dijon and the vinegar and the oil, so that you don't have to worry about it if you want to keep it for a couple of days.
The best quickie vinaigrette recipe I get the biggest kick out of, Jacques Pepin's little trick. You get to the end of the Dijon mustard jar and it's just about all gone.
Yeah.
And you go ahead and put all the ingredients for your vinaigrette in that jar, besides adding any extra mustard. And just shake the bejesus out of it. And every time you want to use it, just shake the bejesus out of it and pour a little bit out on a spoon and you dress whatever. And
well, I remember but when I was a little girl,
terrific.
My mom used to make that.
That's just terrific.
That thing in the jar with the packet and the oil. I mean, we used to love that when I was a kid. I mean, that was, what was that stuff called?
Jacques Pepin was a pretty accomplished cat. You know, right?
He's one of the greatest chefs of our lifetime.
But like, this is a common sense little, like,
That's
you know,
good. I like
Cheeto
that.
Dijon vinaigrette
well,
to use
on top
for all
of it,
kinds
it
of
utilizes
things.
The whole jar. I mean, we're all like standing there trying to scrape the, you know, it's not the easiest thing to get every bit. I mean, we don't want to waste any food, so it's a good way to use the rest of the mustard.
The other half of this email from Lewis or Louisa in Towson is, do you have a good ranch dressing recipe?
Oops, no. I've never made ranch before.
I only ever think of your niece.
Oh.
Who, I think for about a 5-year period, only ate food that was covered with ranch dressing.
Well, I think she just loves... my family, because,
ranch?
Well, they eat a lot of... that's funny. They eat a lot of lettuce and salads in their home. She grew up that way, but she did grow up in North Carolina. And, well, not that that has anything to do with it, but she loves ranch. And they were in California and at a very nice restaurant. She was a little girl, and then the waiter came up to the table and they were talking about the dressing on the salad. And she said, do y'all have ranch? And my sister was sort of mortified. But nevertheless, ranch dressing is really quite yummy. I know it is, and a lot of people like it, but I've never made it. So
hey, they wouldn't be putting it on Doritos if it wasn't good,
right? I don't know how to make it.
Let's go to some of the calls that we have. Kathleen and Haverda Grace. There are two calls here that are perfect together.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call. I do listen to your show when I have time, so it's really great to hear this. But
thank you.
I'm not sure... your assistant said, you know, to lead with one. So anyway, I have three short stories. The first one is, I've been married for 33 years. I've known my husband for 36 years. And one of the first breakfasts he ever made me was French toast. And so I, you know, love French toast and, you know, real maple syrup and everything. And I took my first bite and I thought, something is drastically wrong.
Oh, no.
And he had put garlic in it.
Golly.
Because he was thinking, you know, eggs and garlic, not eggs and maple syrup. And I was like, don't you ever
cut garlic. That's
gross.
That's a male perspective. There's a lot of thinking and a lot of care there.
Oh, my gosh.
And he made you breakfast.
Well, it was nice of him to make
you. He was trying to be kind,
right? Right?
And everything,
yeah,
you know,
we can't fault him for that part.
Never again. Never again.
Well, you told him. You told him.
Yeah. And then the first time I baked a cake, I think I was 10, and it was just a box cake because my mom wanted to get me used to baking and everything, and we made everything from scratch otherwise. But so I put it in the oven, you know, I did everything the way it said, and, you know, I was waiting for it to bake and everything, and I took it out, and it was completely flat and burnt because my oldest brother had turned the oven on broil for a joke.
Oh, my gosh.
So. Wow. My mother looked at him and said,
"That was a bit of a disappointment.
You get to have the first piece."
As justice in your family.
Yeah, right?
You know,
oh, my goodness.
Justice.
Wow.
So,
very good.
And the last one is, I grew up next to Canada, I lived in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and my father worked with a lot of Native Americans, and he worked with this woman who was a princess in her tribe, and he told us that... she gave him this beaver tail. It was in the middle of winter, of course, so, you know, like what Boston had, that's what I grew up with, this, you know, this winter.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really bad. I mean, it was disgusting because there's only meat around the edge of the spine, and the rest is all fat. And he kept saying, well, we have to eat it because she'll know if I'm lying and everything, that I told her that we eat it. We didn't eat it. And so I'm from a family of 11. So literally there's one bulb hanging over the kitchen table, and we're all sitting there like, really, Dad? And my mother's version is that she gave him $5, and it was Tuesday, and payday was on Friday. And he went to the store, and he came home with beaver tail and frozen peas.
Oh, my.
So we ate a lot of frozen peas that night for dinner. But she's like, you know, really, Jim? Like, you know, so. But anyway.
Thank you for sharing.
Humor.
Yes, definitely. Thank you for sharing
I want to take you back very quickly to your first one.
Oh. Uh-huh.
Has your husband made you French toast since then?
Yes, but with very strict ingredients.
Much guidance.
Very good.
All right.
Very good.
I live in the house, so whatever, but thank you.
Thank
you,
Kathleen.
For the call.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Julie in Baltimore, who has a garlic theme question, I think, as well.
Hi, Julia.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm fine. I just had to call and commend you on being a cook and saying you don't like garlic.
Well, thank you.
And I have listened to a lot of cooks, seen a lot of cooks on TV, and they just throw the garlic in willy-nilly, you know. And it's personally, I can't do garlic.
And a lot of people can't.
Cindy doesn't do anything willy-nilly. Let me reassure you.
Thank you, Julia.
Well,
we appreciate it.
I about fell off my couch when I heard Cindy say that. She doesn't like garlic. I'm like, no, wait a minute.
Well, thank you, Julia. I appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you for the call. When we come back on Formula Wolf on Food & Wine, we're still taking your calls, 410-662-8780 on WYPR.